All right, this is The Nose, our weekly cultural roundtable. I'm going to tell you, before I even introduce our wonderful panelists, I'm going to tell you that we're going to begin the show by talking about the new Spider-Man Homecoming movie. And then in the second segment, we are going to update you on something that I'm 100% certain that we've talked about this in the past, but there are new developments in the monkey selfie case. If you don't know what that is, well, we'll explain it to you. And we're also going to talk about one of the real controversies of the week, which is a David Brooks column in which he basically said that although there are structural inequalities that cause people socioeconomic distress in America, what's even worse is like how complicated sandwiches are. And how complicated everything else that goes with sandwiches and cultural markers and stuff like that. But the sandwich thing and the anecdote that prompted it has touched off a huge thing on Twitter. And so to get you in the mood, we this morning, Kyone Wolf and I wrote a sandwich song, and here it is.
It's called a Lorenzo with a mild soppressata. What kind of a name for a sandwich is that? It's one part bruschetta and two parts frittata. For a non-foodie gal, this is no welcome mat. Complicated sandwiches, is there nothing better to do? Complicated sandwiches, I'd like to bid them adieu. 'Cause when you say bon me, my only thought is bon you. Your French mortadella seems a little bit phony. If you were a sandwich, you'd be full of bologna. You're an eaty gourmet with the soul of a fool. You've traded plain tacos for elite gabagool. Complicated sandwiches, even when I don't want to. Complicated sandwiches, must they all have cilantro? Why can't I just have a Dagwood the way I long to? In a nothing burger world, we've had smoked love on rye, but the dish of the day is bacon, lettuce, and goodbye.
Yes, a sandwich breakup song. So anyway, we'll deal with that topic a little bit later. We wanted to get you in the mood for that. And so let me tell you who's here. Sam Hatch is co-host of the Culture Dogs on Sunday nights on WWUH. It's going to just work out fine for you this week. You can listen to the Culture Dogs just as you're getting ready for Game of Thrones.
Perfect.
Yeah, it just sets up just perfectly. Carolyn Payne is an actress, comedian, dancer, and founder, director, and choreographer of Kinetic Dance. She's also the hero of today's show. Rebecca Castellani was supposed to be on. Carolyn was, in fact, on with us last week. Carolyn took ill. We sent out a call. Jonathan McNichol sent out a call. We particularly felt we should have a woman on the panel here. And Carolyn volunteered. This is like last night, right? At 9 o'clock or something.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. It was like, go see a movie. Yeah.
So she had, told her that she agreed to go see a movie. Yeah. And like at 9 o'clock last night, she agreed to study up on the topics and get ready. Pedro Soto is also a hero. He came all the way up here from – he's sort of part of our New Haven Nose team. But there are certain things that we can lure Pedro up for. And I figured Spider-Man was one of them. He's chief operating officer at Spacecraft Manufacturing in New Haven. So we're going to begin with Spider-Man or Spider-Man Homecoming specifically. I guess maybe to contextualize this a little bit. Well, we love Spider-Man. I believe he was introduced in comic books in 1962. But in the movies, because Spider-Man has to be very young, the franchise kind of turns over about every 5 years or so. Tobey Maguire began it all exactly 15 years ago, I think, and then Andrew Garfield. And now it's a young man named Tom Holland. Maybe we'll just, before we start talking about it, we'll have a little conversation, a little clip from the movie. What am I looking at here? So this is the young Tom Holland as Spider-Man. I think this is when his friend – it's when his friend realizes that he's Spider-Man. Yeah, he's got sort of a sidekick friend. Here we go.
You're the Spider-Man from YouTube.
I'm not.
You were on the ceiling.
I wasn't. Ned, what are you doing in my room?
May let me in. You said we're going to finish a Death Star.
She doesn't know. Nobody knows. Well, I mean, Mr. Stark knows because he made my suit, but that's it.
Well, Tony Stark made you that. Are you an Avenger?
Yeah, basically. Dude, you can't tell anybody about this. Gotta keep it a secret.
Well, secret why?
Because you know what she's like. If she finds out people try and kill me every single night, she's not gonna let me do this anymore.
Okay. I'll level with you. I don't think I can keep this a secret. This is the greatest thing that's ever happened to me.
I can't believe this is happening right now.
Okay, they talk really fast in their squeaky little voices. And you know, I mean, Pedro, in a way, it's kind of interesting what a difference 2 or 3 years in the age of a character makes. Tobey Maguire, as the original Spider-Man, was graduating from high school. That first right. movie sees him make the leap from high school to his after-high school years. So presumably he's 17 or 18 years old. We know in this movie that that this Spider-Man is 15 years old. And I think we're also living in an era of series like Stranger Things mm-hmm. and stuff like that kind of maybe celebrate a slightly younger version of America. You know, there's something about this Spider-Man. He seems like immature in every possible way.
Yeah, I think this Spider-Man movie in a very good way made me feel old. Like I was like, I'm looking at kids that are closer to my son's age rather than, you know, my age. So I thought that it was a really great, it really felt like a movie about kids and about what if you're a kid in this Marvel universe that happens to get superpowers, but you're, you know, 14, 15 years old.
Right. So, and Carolyn, we were talking about you being a millennial. So, supposedly this is the Spider-Man for millennials, and that maybe there's sort of some of the references and some of the attitudes you'd be on the opposite end of the millennial spectrum, I think, from these characters. But I don't know. Did it work that way for you?
Yeah, I love that he was just kind of this, you know, awkward mess of a teenager, and that translated into who he was as a superhero, that he just kind of can't quite get it right. He's just, you know, this like gangly teenager, and that's who he is even as a superhero at this point. So I thought that kind of made him this really quirky, lovable character and sort of more interesting in some ways to me. Like it gave it more It made it more realistic, if you're going to say that, for a superhero movie. And I have to say, like, I didn't hate this. And I am not a huge, if you listen to the nose, you know, I'm not like a huge lover of superhero movies. And the only reason I've seen ones recently has been because of the nose. And I think this one is probably my favorite.
Sam, I think all of us saw echoes, just to say, with this teenage theme of, I mean, there's sort of like John Hughes movie moments here.
Absolutely.
There's, I think, also a little bit of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, who was, I thought, maybe the first, you know, Buffy used to like have to like save the world, but she'd have SATs the next day, right? And there's a little bit of that here.
Yeah, and I always loved that about the Spider-Man character, that whole concept, whereas most of us were worrying about how they could work at their grocery store job at night and fit in studying, that he was doing this, you know, larger than life activity at night and saving the world sometimes literally. And then, yeah, still having to worry about that exam the next day. And yeah, they really pulled it off in here. There's some direct nods to John Hughes and particularly Ferris Bueller's Day Off. It also reminded me a lot of Anton Yelchin's character in the film Charlie Bartlett, which also featured Robert Downey Jr.
He reminded me so much of that actor.
As a mentor. So, yeah, I thought that was pretty interesting. I don't know if anybody else, but I'm glad somebody else did pick up on that.
Yes.
In terms of mentor, I might want to say that Robert Downey Jr. may be the first anti-mentor.
Right.
In terms of a hero, anti-hero.
Which is great, because so much of Spider-Man is him as a teen kind of dealing with how to go wrong as an adult. And he's got he doesn't have a father figure, so he's got all these other father figures in this movie that are kind of extreme. And he has to determine, you know, his own path.
Right. So this is a movie in which the young Spider-Man, and all of this is set up in what I thought was a completely terrible movie, the Captain America Civil War movie. But he's keenly aware of the Marvel comic universe around him. He's keenly aware of his opportunity to enter that universe. So we do see a lot of Robert Downey Jr. as Tony Stark kind of reverse mentoring him. And I don't know, Pedro, I said this in the emails too. This was an area where I was a little bit uncomfortable, because there's a way in which this movie franchise is kind of in love with itself and in love with its own tropes. And there's a way in which I could tell already that Sam had a similar relationship to Spider-Man that I did as a comic book nerd, which was that there was something essentially very lonely about Spider-Man, mm-hmm. and he solved all of his own problems on his own. This included in the early days of the comic book how to get his uniform clean. He'd have to wait for Aunt May to leave so that he could use the washing machine. You know, it was stuff like that. But everything was always kind of, you know, on his own. The Fantastic Four would invite him to join. He'd say, I just can't do it. And here there's like a creep here, right? Yeah. Like Tony Stark is there all the time and he's putting all this gadget crap inside the uniform. That was bothering me.
Yeah. No, I think that it changes the character. It changes kind of the arc of the character. But it also puts him sort of in opposition with Tony Stark, who's like, you know, Tony Stark makes a huge mess of Spider-Man's, of Peter's life, in that he comes in, gives him this enormously powered suit. You know, he goes, rescues in Civil War of the day and, you know, or that battle, I guess. I haven't seen Civil War. And then, you know, and then says, like, see ya, kid. And then, you know, he's reaching out. Peter Parker's reaching out for Tony during the movie and is literally just getting blown off. And so I think it works, but I do think that I think they needed to do something like this to kind of bring him into the sort of Tony Stark universe of the MCU.
I want to talk a little bit about the cast of this movie, too. So, I mean, there's sort of Tom Holland and there's Robert Downey Jr. And then, I mean, Carolyn, there's this sort of incredibly widespread of little casting things. Like Tyne Daly's in it for, I don't know, 90 seconds or something, you know. But there are all these kind of little ingenious things. But the one thing that they clearly have made a vow to do is diversify. So the mise-en-scène is some kind of school for math and sciences and engineering. That's the high school that Spider-Man goes to now, which means, you know, that the big jock Flash is now this little nerdy guy. It's the guy from Grand Budapest Hotel. But the cast is diverse. There are people of a lot of different colors and ethnicities here, and also a lot of really interesting actors, including your friend and occasional performing colleague Hannibal Buress.
Yeah, and I thought he was hilarious. His delivery. He plays this coach who one of his pretty much main purpose in the film is to facilitate these Captain America PSA videos that the school has to show. That he doesn't really seem eager to show because he's like, well, he's sort of a war criminal now, yeah, right. But the school says I show this. Yeah.
They're sort of like health class videos.
Right. Yeah. I love Hannibal, and I thought his performance in this was really fun. He had told me, like, yeah, I filmed this. I have like one line. And I thought that. I liked all the characters, like, you know, Tyne Daly coming. And I thought Michael Keaton, for me, was a really neat villain.
Yeah, I love the Vulture. I think it really brought something to the table with that character that, I don't know, I wasn't expecting much of the Vulture. So
let's talk a little bit about that. Yeah, Pedro, I know that you had some thoughts about that,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I mean, I actually think that the Marvel Cinematic Universe is actually full of awful villains. They're all just terrible, except for Loki. Tom Hiddleston is amazing. Everyone else is kind of subpar. Michael Keaton as the Vulture, and again, he's the best thing about it is that he's not called the Vulture. I don't think they even mention it. He's just this guy. He's a thief of technology. You know, the man has kind of stumped him down. But I thought
he's kind of Trump era. I think,
he is
right?
A Trump era guy, and I think that he's really. I think. He feels like a real character. There's like a connection. There's pathos. There's actual. You know, he's not trying to destroy the world. He's trying to make money. I won't spoil things on why he's making money. And I think that it's just a really and Michael Keaton obviously acts the pants off of the character. Mm-hmm. So.
Right. I mean, I when I say of the Trump era, too, I don't mean a rich Trump kingpin, right? He's like this kind of scrap dealer who basically feels he's being left out. And he's getting screwed by Stark Industries, which I completely believe.
And that's a fact. Yeah. I mean, it is kind of a fact.
It's a fact.
Yeah. It's actually happening.
Yes.
Tony Stark has vertically integrated his mayhem so that his own company cleans up his messes.
Mm. I mean, there's a twist we can't really give away, but there's sort of an encounter that he and Peter Parker have later in the movie where, I mean, Carolyn, he just isn't this. He isn't even like an Albert Molina, Dr. Octopus archvillain. He's just kind of this guy who's maybe a little bit to the wrong side of the line, right?
Yeah, you get that I think Michael Keaton is one of those actors who fascinates me. Just his face, his voice. I like seeing him in things, and he is that kind of villain where he's in that gray area, and especially with, you know, things that we don't want to give away here. You do feel it's humanized, and I think that that's one of the things that this whole movie did for me that other superhero movies haven't necessarily. Because of how he was this, like, fallible teenager, and because of who the villain is and the situation, everything did seem a lot more humanized with it.
Yeah, and that one chat that he has with Peter Parker is so intense, and there's just so much violence brewing underneath the surface.
Mm-hmm.
And,
but a recognizable kind of chat that they're having.
Exactly,
too.
Right. Yeah.
Exactly.
And so, I mean, Sam, also, one thing we have to say is that these Marvel Comic Universe movies now have become these incredibly complicated marketing operations, too, where all kinds of things, teasers and stuff, are buried in the movie, sometimes at the end, sometimes in the middle. There are constant suggestions about what other movies might be in the works.
Sure.
So you're watching Guardians of the Galaxies. At the end, you go, wait a minute, is Sylvester Stallone going to be like in some kind of, you know, it's just like, and so here, for example, Donald Glover, who's yes. really kind of emerging as one of the very accomplished comic actors of his generation, is there for a heartbeat, for a couple of funny little scenes. He has a terrific line where he's talking to Spider-Man and says, in just a total deadpan Donald Glover tone, you got to get better at this part of the job. and so he's there, but if you're a nerd, mm-hmm. I'm not pointing at you, but if you're a nerd, you know from the name of the character that he has that actually is a character with some larger significance. It's quite possible that, and so that goes on all the way through, right? We're all the whole time we're thinking, oh, well, there must be some other movie coming with that guy doing this, right?
Yeah, and there's so many iterations of these characters too, and Donald Glover's character is hinting at a Spider-Man character from quite a while ago, but that I had almost half forgotten about. And there's so many of them, and each of them have been played by different characters within this universe over the years as these series keep getting reinvented. So you really have to be on top of your game to actually recognize some of the names that get thrown at you. But on the flip side, I don't mind that they inject all these little Easter eggs in there if it works in a satisfying story fashion. So, yeah, Donald Glover's appearance in the film works on its own, whether or not you know he's a member of a larger Marvel lineage or not. And as long as it's satisfying from a story potential.
Where it's not like
I'm
a two-hour trailer for another movie or
exactly,
other movies.
Exactly, yeah.
No, I think – see, Pedro, I think it sort of has changed how we movie today. You know, I just turned movie into a verb. But
I like
so,
it.
Like how we movie. So how we movie with these movies is we go to the movie and we enjoy the movie. I think as Sam said, I don't think that it's intrusive in any way. But then we're also kind of making like a little mental record. Like, what's that? Maybe we need to find out more. So then you go home and you hit IMDb,
you know,
and you start looking all kinds of stuff up. And then the other thing is we really won't give away any of the surprises, but you really have to wait through the very, very last freaking credit. Because how you movie these days, right?
Exactly. I think that's, that was almost like the meta end credit, right? I mean, I think it's just there's so much in these movies. I think to some degree they're meant for repeat viewing once you see it at home. They're meant for post-discussion blogging of Easter eggs. You know, I'm going to go look at – and I think they do help kind of support each other. And I really think that, you know, these Marvel MCU movies are really a genre of their own at this point.
Sure.
And they are – I think they – by keep, you know, scaffolding and adding all these things, I do worry a little bit that at some point it's going to collapse because, like, you know, you'll have 2.5 hours of just reference. But I think that, you know, they're doing it pretty well so far.
Surprisingly well.
Yeah.
But Pedro, could I also say, like, I think that they went even further this time, at least maybe – I mean, this was sort of – it was kind of tickling me the entire movie that, and this is once again not a spoiler, not a giveaway. We've already kind of made it clear. But Michael Keaton, to the extent that he plays a nameable villain, he plays a nameable villain called the Vulture, and the Vulture has wings and he flies around. And of course, Michael Keaton is most recently famous for a non-Marvel Comics Universe movie in which he played a faded out comic book hero with wings who flew around. So this is like, I don't know. You're making the same gesture I was making.
Yeah.
This is like a $19 million joke. Or something, right?
Yeah, that's kind of I thought of that this morning, and I saw the movie this morning at 9 a.m.
She's still digesting her popcorn, right?
Yeah. And I was alone in the movie theater, so I felt no shame in, like, using my phone to, like, Google things and bothering anyone else with the light of my phone. But I actually found myself Googling, like, is this a joke? Are they punking me? Like, that he is Birdman, like, that, you know, he's this vulture character, and he had just done this Birdman movie. So to me, sometimes with these Marvel movies and any movie that does this kind of, as you called it, like this like scaffolding where they're building all of these pieces into it, it's a lot of work. You know what I mean? Like, I feel and with these where I kind of feel like I'm behind the curve anyway, like this is not my universe. I don't know a lot. I don't want something where I have to put in that kind of work and investment in pretty much anything I do ever, especially going to see a movie. So,
or making breakfast, as she right. making cereal. She said before we went on the air,
too much scaffolding.
Putting milk on top of cereal would be way too much.
So much extra work in your day. So, I get nervous when I feel a movie is gonna make me have to go in with knowledge, mm-hmm. or that I'm going to have to like turn to blogs and look things up and kind of really dig deep and research to just enjoy a movie.
Although, I mean, I think you could also argue, Sam, I don't know, maybe I'm going taking this too far, but the culture has always been scaffolding and culture has always been layers. As Jonathan McPants is pointing out to me right now, Birdman is also a little bit of a meta joke about Michael Keaton's past as Batman. But I mean, you know, people going to see Shakespeare at the Globe Theater would be picking up all kinds of references to stuff too, right? I
sure. mean, and in terms of the Marvel Comics history, that was always something that they excelled at, obviously to sell more comics. But there was always a little, you know, sidebar, you know, C-ish, you know, number right, seven yeah. of Iron Man for yeah, this. So it really is following up on a Marvel heritage. And again, there is the threat that it's going to become this monstrosity, because there really isn't a cinematic template for this. Not you know, there's been large series, the James Bond series and everything, but nothing this interconnected and interwoven. So I'm fascinated they've been able to pull off that same template that was used in the comic books to spread the story across multiple titles.
So Pedro's fear is that James Bond will show up in one of these.
He
movies,
might.
Right?
Yeah, he's exactly. on his way. Yeah.
The no, whole thing starts to get
I
in.
Mean, yeah, I think that it's we'll see as the years progress sort of how this goes. I think one of the good things with the Spider-Man movie was that it was not an origin movie.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Which
thankfully.
Was fantastic. But it was sort of, you know, an introduction of the character and moving things along. But it also it had a lightness because it didn't have 1,000, you know, superheroes in it. It was fairly compact in terms of what was happening in the movie. Even the big, you know, finale. The nice thing is that it really kept everything into about as small of a Peter Parker box as you could with a modern action movie. I mean, obviously there's, you know, there's the requisite destruction of a landmark and the requisite destruction of, large form of transportation, which happens in the movie. There's obviously a battle in the sky, which happens in the Marvel movies. But the scale of everything and what the stakes were all fairly sort of Peter Parker sized.
Well, we're running out of time here, although there's one or two points that I wanted to make or explore with you guys. So I actually went back and watched some of the very first Tobey Maguire, because I'm a Spider-Man movie, because I like the sort of bruised quality that Tobey has. You know, I mean, he's, first of all, that movie begins, interestingly, with a little voiceover monologue from the Peter Parker character saying, this isn't the movie you think it is. It isn't really about a superhero. It's a movie about a girl. And then there's a big shot of Kirsten Dunst there. And it is very much a movie about this complicated attempt at finding romance. And also, of course, this incredible movie about overwhelming Ibsen-sized guilt, Strindberg-sized guilt that just runs through this movie. And there's obviously something a lot more frolicsome and happy and jittery about this. I do want to say that if there's been a piece of controversial casting, it's probably Marissa Tomei as Aunt May. So, Caroline, I'm going to start with you. I mean, obviously, Rosemary Harris played Aunt May originally.
Untouchable. I mean, in terms of the comic book character.
Right. Yeah. It's great. Rosemary Harris, who has had this incredible career in British theater, And then also, you know, pretty significant career in movies of the 50s and 60s. If you go on her Wikipedia page, it says Rosemary Harris, known for playing Aunt May. It's like, okay, that's who you are.
Alec Guinness, known
for
playing.
Well, when we did the nose about the Captain America and they teased the whole Spider-Man thing and it became evident that Marissa Tomei was playing Aunt May, I remember Colin saying, you know, in case you thought you were getting off this good earth without wanting to be attracted to Aunt May.
I may have said it even more bluntly than that.
But. Yeah, I tried to edit that. So every time I kept seeing trailers for this, I would hear Colin's voice saying that and start to laugh because to me that was true because I obviously, you know, was aware of Spider-Man. Like I'm not, you know, total. I don't live under a rock or anything, so I do know who these characters are, and I did know that Aunt May was like a frumpy old lady.
It'd be so hard to live under a rock anyway. You have to keep lifting the rock up.
That would be too much work. I already expressed I'm not into that much work. But you know, you'd expect someone more like Tyne Daly to be playing Aunt May more than Marissa Tomei. Like if you were gonna choose between the two, if you had just seen, you know, headshots of actors, you would have been like, oh, this is gonna be playing Aunt May. But they kept referencing, I just thought it was funny, at the beginning part of the movie, there were like several references to how hot she is.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if that was going to play out somewhere in the movie and they just sort of like let that drop. It was just like they were just kind of rolling with this joke. Like, look, we know Aunt May is hot. Okay, now we're going
to
move on.
There's many movies to come. They'll do something with that. But but yeah, it also raises the question about whether Spider-Man is an Italian-American, you know,
yes.
Because she is
the hot Italian.
The bodega guy says she's a hot Italian chick. So is Spider-Man Italian? We don't know yet. And just very quickly, too, Pedro, just to sort of wrap that whole thing up. So we've gone from Kirsten Dunst to I have no idea who the female lover just was in the Andrew Garfield movies. I saw them, but they made no impression on them. But MJ, can we give this away?
I don't know.
No.
Yes.
No.
Well,
I love.
It's cute enough to.
Okay, we
keep
won't do it. We
end.
Won't do it. Never mind.
We can talk about who is it? Liz. His.
Yeah, we can. Anyway, we can. Well,
we can talk about who it's not.
Yeah. I guess we can't talk about that either.
I love Zendaya's character. It felt like something out of Scott Pilgrim versus the World or an anime series. Yeah. Just kind of
a little bit Scott Hughes, a little bit to John Hughes too.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah,
definitely. Yes.
Anyway, I guess we're not going to do any. We're not going to spoil anything. All right.
No.
Instead, we'll take a break. We'll come back and we'll find out what universe Carolyn Payne really does live in. It's not this one. All right, we're back. We're doing the nose. Carolyn Payne is late making an Avenger-style rescue of the nose, coming to our aid at the last minute because Rebecca Castellani couldn't do it today. Pedro Soto is the chief operating officer at Spacecraft Manufacturing. And Sam Hatch, well, Sunday night, you're going, come on, Game of Thrones, start, you know? And then
what am I going to do with my night?
The seconds are ticking away. Well, at 8 o'clock, you can turn on WWUH, listen to the Culture Dogs. I'm going to guess you might even talk a little bit about that, right?
Yeah, I'm excited. Super excited for winter to come, finally.
All right. Winter is coming.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah. Spoiler alert. Winter's here. Actually, winter was here at the end of the last season. All right. We're not talking about that right now. Instead, we're going to talk about David Brooks, a columnist for the New York Times, had a column this week that began, I guess, maybe innocuously enough and seemed as though it could be like your typical David Brooks column, which in many ways it was. But anyway, the title was How We Are Ruining America. A lot of things could follow that particular title. He begins by talking about structural inequalities in the education system, in housing, and stuff like that. And then, and I think it's – well, anyway, then he starts talking about informal social barriers, and he writes, "Recently I took a friend with only a high school degree to lunch. Insensitively, I led her into a gourmet sandwich shop. Suddenly, I saw her face freeze up as she was confronted with sandwiches named Padrino and Pomodoro and ingredients like soppressata, capicolo, and a striata baguette. I quickly asked her if she wanted to go somewhere else, and she anxiously nodded yes, and we ate Mexican." Maybe I read that unfairly. I don't know. And then he goes on to talk about all these sort of cultural markers, which are essentially class markers. And then people just begin to make fun of him. And even if you never heard of David Brooks before the week began, if you have a Twitter account or maybe even a Facebook account, by the end you certainly knew about this whole big mess with these sandwiches. I don't know. Pedro, does he have any kind of point, at least when he gets to this thing?
No. Well, I mean, his example, just to pick apart this, just the his exact those paragraphs. I mean, that's like Vito's Deli in New Haven, right? It's like
Max Bebo up here.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I just don't even understand. It's like I almost feel like he created this anecdote because if he went sort of like, oh, we went to a Vietnamese restaurant and my friend left, the friend would appear to be, you know, racist in some way, right? And which is sort of like the Mexican kicker. Like, it's just this whole construct, I feel like, is just doesn't work. It's you know, what he's talking about, you know, and the fact that he says, like, this is worse than the other very good points that he makes about how rich people keep kind of taking the ladder away from everyone. But, you know, these cultural signifiers that we do, I mean, I feel like nowadays it's all very flat. Like, for just a quick example, you know, like Starbucks and the coffee. I mean, like, you know, everyone drinks Starbucks now, but, you know, Starbucks, they have a nitrogen-based coffee, which I guess is all the rage out in the West Coast, right? So it's like Guinness coffee.
Yeah.
Like a month later, now Dunkin' Donuts has it. So like the cultural flattening of something which was a super exclusive coffee, it's hitting Dunkin' Donuts 2 months later. You know, kind of like fast fashion where things are on the runway and then are in there. So I just feel that there is this the much faster pace of stuff that things get to a pretty accessible level pretty quick these days.
Yeah, I know. You know, that's a really great point. First of all, I love the way that you express that. And I feel as though, like, Sam, today I was actually listening to Silvio Poggioli talk about coffee in Italy. And I was thinking, and I was listening very carefully because I'm thinking of going to Italy in late September. And I thought, you know, and that's when you're in a foreign country and you really don't know how people order things. And But I don't feel like, I mean, I think we're all just dealing with precious little sandwiches and precious little coffee things all the time. I don't think that's a Rosetta Stone that people can't decode.
It was a shocker in the 90s. I remember my first encounter at Starbucks, and I literally had a like Paul Rudd's character in Role Models where he freaks out about, you know, a venti.
There's a reference that everybody could get.
Yeah, I did that in a Starbucks in West Hartford in like, you know, mid-90s or so. But yeah, after a while, it becomes so saturated. But I mean, I do appreciate how there is that aspect of it's your problem that you don't know Italian in a non-Italian restaurant situation. Whereas I just saw Dunkin' Donuts started opening up stores in the greater Los Angeles area. And they had these little like helpful pamphlets and like little stepping stones to get you through the Dunkin' Donuts experience. What we are. What are these strange items we're serving? Whereas Starbucks didn't do that when it came. It's just deal with this.
Right. What on a Dunkin' Donuts menu requires a pamphlet?
Apparently, Californians are completely bewildered by Dunkin' Donuts. Yeah, it was necessary.
You can eat breakfast in the afternoon.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I have to say, here's my Papoulian through line here is that if, in fact, Spider-Man is an Italian-American guy.
which he is, apparently.
Which he apparently is. Well, I mean, you know, one of the three indecipherable terms that was apparently on the menu board at this gourmet sandwich shop was capicolo, which in Tony Soprano terms is gabagool, right? Yeah. That's what a gabagool is, gabagool. So, like, the idea that that's somehow or other placed out of reach of the average person, to me, it's a little bit more of a commentary on these days you have to navigate, as Pedro's saying, a more polycultural experience.
Sure.
You're going to go in someplace and somebody's going to mention a banh mi or something like that, and you either know what that is or you don't. But, I mean,
and you pronounce it wrong and they kind of smile at you and you go on about your day.
Or you Google it on your phone.
That's
and
what
you
I
know
do
what it
at
is.
Restaurants all the time.
What is that?
I have found myself Googling things on restaurant menus and trying to decipher what it is. And, you know, oftentimes it's like some sort of exotic cheese or something, or, you know, some sort of meat on it. Like, I just feel like it's something that now they all everywhere does want to sound very fancy. So they will throw around these words and it's this like foodie culture.
It's more a foodie thing than a class.
Right. I feel like the foodie culture is more snobby than anything. I think that's I think that's where the divide comes in.
Right. But as Pedro is saying, the foodie culture is about 45 miles up the road from Soprasada, right?
Right. I mean,
the foodie culture.
Yeah, they've moved past that.
Yeah.
The stuff I mean, that Subway has.
This is the trickle down of all of us non-foodies trying to catch up to that.
Yeah, that's why showing up at Dunkin' Donuts and
this
places
is where the,
now,
the common ruck gets to try the stuff that the foodies
what
have
is
been
this fancy stuff?
Bored with. Yeah.
Right.
I just want to say one last thing about this. This is somebody who else who writes columns. And I, by the way, have met David Brooks. He's been on this show once or twice. And he actually is kind of a nice guy. but he writes these columns. And I can tell you exactly where this column went off the rails. It was doing fine. Mm-hmm. And then he wrote this. He was talking about this book by Richard Reeves, who's talking about these real, actual structural inequalities that really do hurt people in America. And he writes, I was braced by Reeves' book, but after speaking with him a few times about it, I've come to think the structural barriers he emphasizes are less important than the informal barriers that segregate the lower 80%. So he basically says the fact that people don't have enough money or access to good schools or, you know, the chance to live in neighborhoods that have the kinds of services and stuff that other people, that's less important than, like, knowing what's on the sandwich board or, like, what to say about David Foster Wallace, which was another one of the examples that he gave. Or, yeah, go ahead.
I just can't believe that in his editor didn't just say, that's not the, you know, that's not how any of this works. It's like, no, it's the first part. Stick with the first part.
Well, now it turns out I have another Papoulian through line, which is I was thinking about this. So in this, he does have this other list of things, you know, the right, I don't know, kinds of baby strollers and blah, blah, blah,
sure,
blah, blah,
yeah.
You know. Oh, right. And he does say, and the right attitude towards David Foster Wallace. And I thought, then I my mind was going, I'm kind of proud of this. Like it's 8:30 in the morning and my mind is going, David Foster Wallace, sandwiches. David Foster Wallace, sandwiches. And I suddenly thought about the movie The End of the Tour, where Jason Segel plays David Foster Wallace, and I remembered this.
A lot of women in magazines are pretty in a way that is not erotic because they don't look like anybody that you know.
That's true.
Yeah, like you can't imagine them putting a quarter in a parking meter or like eating a bologna sandwich, whereas Alanis Morissette, I can and have imagined her just like chowing down on a bologna sandwich.
I find her absolutely riveting.
Okay, so there it is. That's right there. I mean, that's basically, you know, what David Foster Wallace needs. He needs a beautiful icon, but not too beautiful, somebody who can eat a bologna sandwich. And apparently that's what David Brooks needs too. So, get some Alanis Morris videos, David. You'll feel better. I don't know if that's really the cure for his problem. But anyway, all right, so we have to move on here. This is a thing that we have dealt with before. Our crack research department, that would be producer Jonathan McPants, has figured out – now I have to scroll all the way back through here to tell – it was on August 18th, 2014.
Wow. I remember it well.
Yes. Mark Oppenheimer, Tracy Wu Fastenberg, and James Hanley were our panelists, and we discussed this controversy. The controversy at the time involved this nature photographer named David Slater, who had taken – who had been photographing a kind of black macaque, a kind of monkey. And the monkey had taken his camera and taken a selfie, and it was a really good selfie. This is radio. There's no way we can.
He made duck lips and everything. It was impressive.
He really did. He just did the whole selfie thing. So it's a great. And so at the time, the main controversy I think had to do with Wikimedia and other sort of sharing sites being uncomfortable with the crediting situation. Like this really did belong. They thought maybe to the monkey. Maybe the monkey had the rights to this picture. David Slater didn't have the right to – there was just like a thing going on there. And I think it was maybe also because Slater was objecting to the way people were using this photo as if he hadn't taken it. I think they were saying, well, a monkey took it. It's fair use. We can use it on Wikimedia.
It's public domain.
It's public domain, yeah. So I think that's how it all started. I think that's what we were talking about back in 2014. But it's gotten more complicated. It's gotten a lot more complicated because PETA has taken upon itself to hire counsel on behalf of said monkey. And to sue David Slater in the American federal court system. And so that's where we pick up our story. And I don't know, Pedro, take it away.
Poor David Slater. I mean, and, you know, it's just I feel really bad for him. But it is really something where, you know, I have a lot of respect for people who want to have animals be more ethically treated. But man, PETA, like you're taking this guy who's trying to save animals and you're suing him because you feel that the monkey needs a cut of this money.
Right. So just to be clear, the monkey in the PETA in the monkey's name, and the monkey may or may not be named Naruto, is
the
monkey is suing David Slater for copyright infringement. I can't even say these things. The monkey is suing David Slater for copyright infringement. And then this poor guy, you know, I mean, he really, if he is to be believed, I mean, he's singing the song of woe. Like, he basically has no money. And I don't know. Carolyn? This seems more like something you would do stand up about than something that you would have.
Yeah, I just am processing this morning, and I don't even – I mean, what is the monkey going to do with the money? I'm not being smart, but, like, honestly, like, what is the end game here? Is this, like, monkey going to collect its settlement and buy a bigger
monkey
habitat
have,
or,
you know,
like,
payments.
Wear some bling? Like, I don't understand what – the end game is with doing this.
It's going to build a house like Sylvester Stallone has in Rocky III, but there's going to be more bamboo.
I just picture this
marble.
Monkey yes. like having its own jet and like taking a selfie in the jet and being like, bam, nailed it, won my case.
But I don't know, Sam, is there any way we can, I mean, obviously PETA is interested in the rights of animals, and as Pedro said, yeah. I mean, in a way it's tragic because there is going to be a case where a monkey has standing. This has been explored a lot about monkeys who are used in lab
okay,
situations. And
the apps, yeah. they have those apps that like if you have an iPad, it has this little thing that moves around and your cat like touches the thing that's moving around and then that takes a picture of your yeah. cat. So effectively your cat is taking a selfie.
First of all, your cat would sue the crap out of you. Yeah. Your cat is vicious.
We're actually
and mean.
Already in court over the commercial that we filmed together. She feels that she got wronged in that deal.
Carolyn has this really mean cat that like bit the cable guy and stuff like that. So,
yeah. That's not several even... people have been personally victimized by my cat. But there's actually an app where you can trick your pet into taking its own selfie. So now are
I didn't know that.
It's a slippery slope.
Right.
Yeah.
So now, like, honestly, if my cat has taken some selfies on my iPad, is she going to be coming after me for posting them on Facebook when she felt she didn't really look her best? I just don't know where we're going with this.
Is there a non-simian precedent for this? I mean, does your property, the camera, your property, if Colin took a selfie on my phone, does he now own that?
And it's actually, I mean, this is getting a little technical here, but the photographer, this wasn't an accident. Like, he set up the camera and kind of left the shutter or the clicker so that, right. you know, the monkeys would kind of take pictures of themselves. So he sort of created the scene. So, yeah, exactly, following
he
that.
He baited that monkey yeah. into a selfie? Right.
He did.
That's where the lawsuit should be.
Yeah, exactly, monkey invasion of privacy.
But this his goal has been all along yeah. to save these monkeys and save yeah. this endangered species yeah. and stuff like that. And ironically, this case has called so much attention to them that it might work out that way, that he actually has done them a favor. He may be destroyed in the process, but
right. yeah, as long as his message doesn't get drowned in the nonsense surrounding it, yeah.
So I guess wait, what, 3 more years, and we'll do another update on this story?
Yeah, I'll be here. That's right up there. The follow-up.
The nose is not letting this story go. All right, we're going to take a little break.
Track team.
Yeah, we're going to come back. We're going to talk about things we endorse.
Monkey do, that's all it is, peaches. Love is monkey see and monkey do. Would I lie to you? Love is monkey see and monkey do. That's all it is.
Today's show was produced by Jonathan McPants, with help from our interns Tim Cohn, Carmen Baskoff, and me, Kyone Wolf. Our executive producer is Katie Tolarski, and happy birthday to Where We Live producer Lydia Brown. The part of Bill Curry was played by Toby Maguire. We'll be back on Monday with news from over the weekend on The Scramble. And now, back to Colin.
We're passing animal pictures around here. Everybody's got a story, it turns out. All right, so it's time to mention some things that we might recommend to you, things that we might endorse. I think I'm going to have Sam go first, so Carolyn, I'm not sure Carolyn's had any time to think about this at all. But so Sam, go ahead.
And this is actually a little bit older, but I've been tripping across it a lot more recently and in tune with the soundtrack for Spider-Man, which was really fun. It had a lot of, you know, stuff from the Ramones, et cetera. But Amazon actually financed this, so you can probably find it on Prime. But the documentary Gimme Danger, Jim Jarmusch did about Iggy and the Stooges in particular, is great stuff, talking about really nasty rock and roll and the MC5 and the, you know, the Detroit music scene. And you get to actually see Iggy Pop as just a regular guy and talking about the different incarnations of the band. A lot of great music in there and a lot of, you know, typical kind of, you know, these kind of rise to sort of fame stories. A lot of heartbreak and things and addictions along the way. But real fascinating work. And Jim Jarmusch shows up for a hot second, too. So if you're a fan.
The title again?
Gimme Danger.
Gimme Danger. It is sort of true that Spider-Man Homecoming, they have, like similar to Baby Driver, they're like the songs don't have any relationship to the time period. Like it's all these songs by the Flock of Seagulls and English Beat and a Spoon song that's like 8 years old. I don't know what it's like. I don't understand how these choices are made anymore. All right, so Pedro, what have you got for us?
Okay, well, just because I'm coming up from New Haven, so I got to give some New Haven love back. In Westville, in the area, there's a 2017 concert series in the afternoon and early evening. I believe it's every Monday through July and through about half of August, 6:30 p.m., near the Mitchell Library right in front. And it's concerts and homemade pies. So people who live in the area can bring in their pies, and you can eat pies and watch some pretty neat local bands. So.
And can anyone go? Or do you have to be from Westville?
Anyone can.
If you say you know Mark Oppenheimer, you can go, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Just mention Oppie's name.
He has a luxury skybox.
Right. Concerts and pies. And when do these concerts take place? I mean, it does sound kind of nice.
Yeah. July 17th, 24th, 31st, August 7th, August 14th. Go to westvilleCT.org for the events. I believe they're called the Beecher Park Summer Concert Series.
It does sound kind of nice, though. Yeah. So it's just kind of an evening thing, right?
Yeah.
All right. And so, Carolyn, do you have anything to recommend? You'd be forgiven. You'd have amnesty.
No, sure. I'll throw some things in here. Okay, so if you want a sandwich where you know everything on the menu and there are no hard words to pronounce, you should go to Metro Cafe in the West End of Hartford. Mm-hmm. I love it there. The guy who owns it is really sweet, and they have really – it's just great food. They have really good coffee and stuff in the morning, so – I figured that would be a good thing to throw in. And also, if you're looking for a good day trip, the Book Barn, and I'm actually not even sure. I think it's Niantic.
Fantastic.
Yeah, is just fantastic.
It's four different locations, too, I think, scattered
Which
throughout.
Actually, yeah. That's, I think, the only like downside to it is that if you're, you know, looking for an autobiography, they're like, well, you have to get in your car and drive down the street. But
it's worth, you know, traveling around town, though.
It is just such a magical place to spend a lazy afternoon.
I did that last year, one Saturday. Just spent the whole day.
Yeah,
it is a great place. All right, so a couple quick housekeeping things. First of all, I forgot to mention the greatest thing about if there's a good thing about the monkey selfie story, it's that one of the things that's being contested is whether or not the right monkey is being named in the lawsuit. Do they really know which monkey it is?
And
it's not Naruto.
David Slater in The Guardian was quoted as saying, "Surely it matters that the right monkey is suing me," which is
they don't have monkey facial recognition. Right.
Yes, let's get on
the poor guy.
It's a line for the ages. also, if you really want to hear that sandwich song we played at the beginning. It'll be up on SoundCloud. We'll put it out on various social medias as well. And I'm sure maybe we'll embed it on the show page for this, which is at wnpr.org/Colin. Okay, so very quickly, building on the sandwich theme, if you really want to get into the weeds about sandwiches, if that's possible, one of the sites that I discovered is called sandwichtribunal.com. And really, it's really a great site, actually. I mean, if you're interested in sandwiches, you have to be really interested in sandwiches. And they've been at it since 2014, and they try to make sandwiches that you've never heard of before, but they do a lot of research into it. And so,
do they have a podcast I can listen to?
All sandwich based.
Yeah,
they absolutely should, but I don't think. And then I was sure. I think I had an experience this week that sort of it's so David Brooksy. It's kind of perfect. I discovered. I bet you Pedro already knows about this, but I just know that you're a good cook. But I cook a lot, and I discovered a new vegetable this week. It's either called celtus or keltus. I don't know which. It's a Chinese lettuce, except you use the stalk. The stalk, you peel the stalk back, and there's this beautiful translucent core that you can chop up and stir fry and do. It has this delicious kind of nutty taste to it. And I'm sure that if you took David Brooks's friend to a restaurant or anything where they had celtus, that would be very upsetting. But but it's not. It's good. Where can you get it to? You can the one place that I found it because my friends Roger and Isabel are growing it at Sub Edge Farm out in Farmington. So that's at least one place where at times you can get celtus. That's CELTUSE. And then lastly, Yeah, I got so lastly, I mean, Game of Thrones does start on Sunday night. I don't have to promote that to you, although we will be doing a show tied somewhat to Game of Thrones, tied somewhat to the musical Hamilton, and tied somewhat to some research into European history. We will be doing a show Tuesday about Bastards. and so please make a note to – and then I've been sort of looking around for something else, you know, that could – because Game of Thrones is going to be 7 episodes and then it'll be done and I'll have to wait 2 years for the last 6 episodes. So N.K. Jemisin, J-E-M-I-S-I-N, has a series of books. I'm starting right now with the 5th season, and these are in the kind of fantasy realm. And so far, so good. I'm a little ways into this first of the books. And if you're looking for something else, anyway, that's a good place to go. All right. Thanks to Sam Hatch and to Pedro Soto, and especially to Carolyn Payne parachuting in at the last minute to save us. And we'll be back on Monday.
Getting on New Britain, Vernon, I already said that one, Avon, Farmington, yeah.